When she was 26, teacher Paula Shaw moved to a place with only 8 streets. The town was Arakoon in far north Queensland, and on those 8 streets were lots of run-down houses, dogs full of ticks, and an adult population that didn't necessarily see school as the most important place for their children to be. Paula's written an account of her nearly 2 years there, in which she learnt firsthand what some of the obstacles are to successful schooling for Aboriginal kids, and ended up fairly angry about it. But at the same time, she also had a pretty amazing girl's own adventure. Paula's with me now in the studio. Hello, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. Good morning.
You're looking nonplussed at Girl's Own Adventure.
No. I can understand that it reads a bit like
it
Girl's
does.
Own Adventure. Let's Writing start... it, I got the sense that, yeah, actually it kind of was.
Yeah. Well, let's start with what made you want to do this, because you must have known that it wasn't going to be the easiest place in the world to go and teach.
Yeah, I think I knew it wasn't going to be the easiest place in the world. Exactly what it was going to be like, I actually didn't have much of an idea. I'd studied anthropology and I'd studied to be a teacher of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander studies, but the difference between book learning and actually in real life having to be in this other culture that is a very, very different culture is a real challenge, and it's difficult.
Yes. Well, can you describe your first day in the classroom?
First day in the classroom was lovely. They were all quiet. They all listened. It was after the first day when it really got interesting and that I started to really understand exactly what kind of a complicated and difficult task was ahead of me. And, you know, things like, you know, I've got 15 kids in my class out of the 26 who are on my roll.
Yeah.
I've got this 15 on Monday, but on Tuesday I've got a completely different 15 kids. Oh, well, there's some overlap, but...
Yeah.
Trying to have a program, a work program for your students that works for kids who have come every day as well as for the kids who you actually haven't seen for the last 3 weeks is an extremely difficult thing to do. You've got kids with very widely differing levels of literacy. You've got kids from different clan groups. There are 5 different clan groups in Arakoon, so you can have...
Some of which do not get on
that. Some of which most certainly do not get along with each other, and it can be really inappropriate to ask, you know, one kid who you think, oh, this kid's got great literacy skills, I'm going to team them up with this kid whose literacy isn't so great and they can work together. Don't just make that assumption that that can work, because there might be a whole host of reasons why that's inappropriate. It might be that those 2 kids are from families that do not get along, or it might be that, in fact, they're from the same family, but you've just asked a niece to tell her auntie what to do.
And you're kind of feeling your way toward this without the language.
Yeah. It is all in another language. Of course, the kids do speak an Aboriginal English and they are learning standard Australian English, and some of them actually speak standard Australian English really well.
Mm.
But there are certainly kids in your classroom who don't understand what you are saying. And in their interactions with each other, it's almost all in Wikmunkan. So trying to key into what is going on with that is pretty hard work.
So who's interpreting?
Often no one.
That's right.
Sometimes your community teacher will. Often it's no one, which means that you need to...
When your community teacher's there.
Yeah, when your community teacher's there, sometimes they'll do it and sometimes that's not a role they take either. Kids translate for each other often, for kids who really have problems understanding standard Australian English. But you get much, much better at simplifying your language, at breaking it down to what you really mean to say.
Can I get you to, because I think one of the things that is interesting in the book is that you have the roll call. Can I get you to do the roll call for us?
Sure. Kalki yora yankapora nakyankwoka korkatane akwukurum awokurum pambigan tamoy bell. Ampabegan Nampanam Kayuka Mudanati, Punkamelia Mapundan, Kumida Shotjo Tisman, Puchamanka Pimagina, Nalamata Kerendan, Kuwepta Kungodama, Kunada Wallumbeng, Tolkaikan, Taibin Gumpa, Kundumban Quinkan Keppel, Kawanka Kawada Koala, Wikmunya Wombi Wulla.
That brings it home, I think, as well as anything, that you are in another country, in
yeah,
effect. You are
absolutely. It's Australia, but it's another country. It's It's another culture. It's a completely other culture. It's more different than a lot of other cultures that I've spent time in, you know.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Paula Shaw, who's written beautifully written, very easy to read, Seven Seasons in Arakoon, which is about her time in a remote Aboriginal school. What time of year did you arrive there?
A beginning of the school year, so January, and it's...
That's the wet.
The wet, yeah.
Pretty horrible time to arrive, I'd imagine.
Kind of, except that everything's really green and lush and looking really quite beautiful. Although, you don't get many hours without the rain.
Mm. Mm. Can I get you to tell me about living there? Because you were right in the middle of town.
Yep. The first house I lived in was opposite what is rather insensitively called Bicentennial Park. And Bicentennial Park is where lots of the big fights happen.
It's came out of the pub and, yeah.
Yeah, people would come out of the tavern, walk down to Bicentennial Park and do their formations, and that's where a lot of the fights would happen. It's also where the church takeaway is, and for a while it's where the church services were held on Sunday mornings. So, from my front veranda I could have a pretty good view of what was going on in town and get a sense of what the day was going to be like by what the foot traffic was doing, whether people were moving kind of in swarms towards a fight, or if it was a nice, calm day. Lots of kids on bikes. And
fights seem to figure fairly prominently.
They do. They're a big part of community life and a big part of how local politics works. I've recently read in a book that Ruth Park wrote about violence as a theatre of the disenfranchised, and it just was like, oh, makes instant sense to me that, yeah, that is what was going on. This is where they have power in their lives, so why wouldn't it be huge?
But you're now in this community and you're in the middle of it, so there's noise, there's heat, there's lots of bad 80s music out of bad speakers.
Yeah, why the speakers are always broken, I don't know, but, you know, it's quite painful to try and go to sleep listening to...
And lots of and a fair bit of stolen cars doing burnouts.
Yeah, there was quite a significant petrol sniffing problem there when I was there, which seemed to almost grow out of the beginnings of the alcohol management plan.
This was 2003 and 4, basically.
Yeah, 2003 and 4. Apparently that has calmed down somewhat, but for a while there it was quite, you know, every day that there'd be another stolen car. The record when I was there was 14 utes stolen in one night.
Where are they stolen from?
The council sheds, the council lockup area. Yeah, they're all council vehicles.
Right. Mm. And one of the things I was really surprised was that when somebody's hooning around in a stolen car, you don't go outside.
It's quite dangerous to go out on the street when there's a car burning around the streets. And I mean, you can, but you do it at your own risk. And, you know, the kids who are driving the cars have excellent, amazing reactions. The tricks you see them do are quite impressive, but you still wouldn't want to risk, being in the way if a car did a big skid or, yeah. There were definitely quite a few times where I was late to school and kids were late to school because there was a stolen car going around and they didn't want to walk down the street.
No. Mm. Amid all this, you're trying to keep kids interested in school, engaged, and you... One of the things you did was you tried the outdoor approach.
Yeah, getting kids out on country is a fantastic thing to do if you can do it. They have more control.
They know
control.
More than you,
they know so much more than I do, definitely, out there. But once again, it's a difficult thing to organise logistically. You need vehicles, you need boats.
You need permission.
You need permission. You need people to drive the boats. You need better... adult to student ratios to get out on country. You can't do it with one teacher and 26 kids. Well, I didn't have 26 kids actually turn up in my class that often. But yeah.
There's one story you tell where you go to this place and they want to go for a swim, and they go for a swim and you notice none of the adults who are there are going to get in the water.
Yeah.
You get in the water because you figure that if something happens, you're a better place to help. But then you notice that they still no adults get in the water.
Yeah. It was quite scary because, it's a reality. There are crocodiles there, and I've seen some enormous crocodiles sliding into the river where I was in a tiny little tinny going along. So you know they're there, but the kids just jumped into the water and they're splashing around, and it looked to me like they didn't actually know how to swim. So I was much more concerned actually about one of them getting washed downstream. Yeah. You know, how you fulfill duty of care in that kind of a situation, I don't really know.
Problematic.
Yeah.
And this is the environment that the Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, came to visit. This is in 2003. What happened the next day with Frankie and the truck?
Yeah, it was quite ironic just after John Howard had been there and been saying, oh, how great the new and improved Aurukun with an alcohol management plan
and
was.
And you were hopping mad, weren't you?
Yeah, I was kept well out of any media's line because, I was really quite angry about, you know, John Howard's refusal to apologise and really no understanding of the complexity of the issues, and turning up and saying he was there to listen and jumping straight in his nicely air-conditioned Land Cruiser and driving off straight away before anybody else actually got to say anything. Frankie, the day after, stole not one of the normal council utes that often got stolen, but the proper big rubbish truck. It was really big and heavy, and, yeah, that one kept people inside till about 11 o'clock in the morning. And he went out of town and came back in and smashed into a telegraph pole, which snapped high up, which meant the pole was hanging from the wires and half the town had no power for a day and a half at least. And that was the part of town where the store was. The store had no power, which means all the fridges went off.
Oh, no.
And, yeah, well, I mean, you're completely reliant on canned and frozen foods.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And refrigeration.
And if those freezers were, I wouldn't buy a chook there for a while.
And I can well
imagine. 38 degrees.
You do tell a great story about your time there, but often what you see isn't easy to live with. It's not easy to witness. There's injured people. There's people hurting each other. There's sick people. There's sick kids. There's sick dogs. It's hard.
It's really hard. That's, you know, and that is basically the struggle for me in the story and in my life in being there was, I wanted to be there and there were things that I really loved about being there, but it was really, really, really hard and exhausting and physically and emotionally draining. By the end, I just couldn't. I physically couldn't do it anymore.
And this is the community that's become notorious since then, last year with the trial of a group of young men and boys who raped a 10-year-old girl.
Mm. Yeah, there are very, very hard things that happen in that community. There are a lot of people whose lives are in total crisis. It's a hard place.
But you also had some fantastic kids.
They are fantastic kids. You know, I, at the same time as feeling like I couldn't do it anymore, I still do feel hopeful about those kids and that community and what's possible because they are spunky, fantastic kids who are really smart.
Some of them are really smart, aren't they? Hubert and
Hubert.
A girl who you also described. I think she's the first into the water in the swimming, actually.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Wilma. Yeah, she's very, very smart. And I would not be surprised if in a couple of years she is part of the local council. She will be making moves in that community politically. She will be a powerful woman. She already is.
But, I mean, will they get the education they deserve?
Hopefully. Some of them will. There are some young women who... Last year I had the opportunity to go back and I actually did talk with some of the young girls who I'd taught when they were grade 4 and 5 and who are now 15 and 16. And there are a couple of those who have been out at boarding school and are doing really well. And there are also a couple of those who are really smart, deserving kids, and I know that they're not going to get there. And part of it is opportunity, and part of it is that they are entrenched in life there, you know, that this is their home, this is their culture, they have family obligations, they can't just leave. And it's also a really difficult thing to ask a kid to do, to go and live in a place where they are in a completely other culture. You know?
Noel Pearson, of course, has called for compulsory attendance, and there's a trial already underway in Cape York, including Aurukun.
Mm-hmm.
Mick Dodson has called the government to account, saying if every kid isn't attending school by next Australia Day, we are letting Aboriginal kids down.
Yeah, you know, yes, that's kind of true, but it's also a very difficult thing to realise. if every kid suddenly turned up at the school, certainly when I was there, we just didn't have the physical resources to deal with it.
So it was not built to be big enough, or the population.
The population has grown.
Right.
The population has certainly grown, but you know, you're talking about young people who have no school behaviours, so they don't know what's expected of them when they come into school. They're not going to, you know, it's not like you can set it up as a classroom, as if in China where they have 60 kids in a class, but they all sit there and listen.
Yeah.
It's young people who are used to being completely autonomous, making their own decisions, deciding exactly where and when they're going to do anything.
Can I ask you a little bit about the things you did that weren't school? Because you love the outdoors, the getting out in the boat, in fishing, and the hunting too.
Yeah, look, I did things when I lived in Arakoon that I had never done before and haven't done much of since, but which really were fantastic opportunities. Getting out on country at any time is pretty fantastic, but the best getting out on country is certainly if you get to go out with traditional owners and have them show you around their place. It's a really, you get to have a bit of an understanding of their place as just so much more than just the trees and the river and the river banks, and you can see that they are part of the landscape and the landscape is part of them. It's a hugely moving experience.
It's completely, and there's an illustration of that when you're on your way to that swim where one girl is concerned because she's not from that country, she's from another country, so she's concerned that someone should put smell on her.
Yeah, yeah.
So that the spirits will recognise her, not hurt her.
Yeah, and having smell put on you is a really moving thing too. When somebody says, I am from this place, I smell right, the spirits and this landscape knows me and my smell, and I want you to be able to be accepted here, so I'm going to put my smell, and literally it is their smell from their armpits.
So they just...
Both hands under their armpits, yep. Cross their arms, hands in their armpits, pull them out and wipe them across your shoulders, across your belly.
Right.
Yeah, sometimes your head and your hair
too.
You
had it done?
Yeah, several times. Yeah.
You also made a bit of a cross-cultural leap of another kind. You had a short love affair with a man who ate Devon and tomato sauce sandwiches, and which I can remember eating with some pleasure as a child, I have to say, and drank Nescafe, and was never happier than when brandishing a bloodstained knife after killing a wild pig.
Yeah, and he is a really lovely man, and he is still my friend. But look, relationships are things that you do fall into in a much more kind of intense and urgent way, because you are dealing with being outside of your culture and you're in a place that is in crisis and you want someone to hold on to, you know? And I had so much more in common with him than I did with much of the rest of the community that suddenly those differences were pretty small, where in the city I'd noticed them a lot more.
Yeah. You now live in a capital city and you work for a government department. What do you miss most about that time?
Oh, there's so much that I miss. I've never felt... I'm going to cry. I never felt as fully alive as I did when I was living there. You know, you are completely engaged and you have to be. That's part of why it's so exhausting. But it's wonderful, you know. Everybody knows you. You have a role. People notice if you're not there.
Mm.
In the city, you just disappear. You don't mean anything. Where you really do there. You have to be involved in life. Some people choose not to be. Some people choose to, you know, they go, they adjust their job while they are there, and then they close their doors and they live in their air-conditioned homes and ignore everything else that's going on out there. But I'm really glad I didn't do that.
Paula, thanks for coming in. Thanks for writing it. It's a very enjoyable read. Paula Shaw's book, Seven Seasons in Arakoon, is just out. It's from Allen & Unwin. I have to say, it's very enjoyable, very easy read, and stuff that I just had not enough idea about, I have to say. If you want to find out any more about Paula's story or have a response to it, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Coming up next on the show, when a hobby turns into an internationally successful business.